Energy Singularity, the Event Horizon Podcast, a podcast where energy blockchain visionaries discuss the future of energy. Join me, Kevin O'Donovan, as I chat with some of the world's leading visionaries to take a realistic view as to what's really going on. Episode 6 is the second of three episodes where we are hearing directly from people who are out there today building businesses in the energy industry using blockchain as a key enabling technology for their solution. In the series so far, we've looked at the overall state of blockchain in the energy industry, the technology, the impact of policy and regulation, and called out many of the elephants in the room. Now, given the dose of realism we've been dishing out so far, a couple of you might be starting to wonder if there is any future for blockchain in the energy industry. Well, there is. And to prove it, I'd like to welcome Dave Martin, co-founder and managing director of PowerLedger. Welcome, Dave.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Dave, for people who may not know you, can you do a quick introduction?
My name's Dave Martin. I'm the managing director and one of the co-founders of PowerLedger. I'm a 20-year energy industry player, I suppose. So my background and my contribution to the formation of the business is absolutely not in the tech space, but more in the development of a new business model to suit emerging technology in the energy space.
And what are you up to at PowerLedger?
PowerLedger is an energy trading platform. So formed in May 2016. In fact, today is our third birthday.
Congratulations. 3 years already. Wow. Now, for transparency, PowerLedger is one of the companies I actually invested in a few years back. Now, it was only $100 worth of Ether, as I simply wanted to see how the whole ICO process worked at the time. But fair play to you. In the blockchain world, being a three-year-old company and still going strong is an achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're hanging in, and I would throw in there that an ICO is also three lifetimes if you ever want to take one of those on. So, it's an interesting environment we find ourselves in, rapidly changing technology space in an industry that typically doesn't like change or deals with change under very different time frames. So an amazing time to be a part of two very distinct but somehow conjoined industries.
So why did you create PowerLedger back in 2016?
We were formed to provide a fundamentally different approach to the buying, selling and trading of electricity. Particularly renewable electricity. So PowerLedger in the last 3 years has undertaken some major transformative projects. We've developed our platform that began with an energy trading arrangement, peer-to-peer trading, and we're now doing energy trading, carbon instrument trading, tracking. And we also have a renewable energy financing platform as well, all built on our core foundational blockchain.
A recurring theme throughout the series is that the energy industry is not moving fast enough. We've had loads of new technologies like blockchain, new innovations, loads of pilots, but the utility industry is still very slow moving. Now, you've been out there for the past 3 years. Are we beginning to move faster? Is there any change happening out there?
I've seen energy companies struggle with the need to adopt new technologies. I've seen them question the validity because of the hype. But in recent times, I've seen them looking over their shoulder, because what we're seeing now is not just a change in technology, we're seeing a change in consumer expectation, we're seeing a change in global drivers around carbon reduction. So we're seeing a multifaceted change in the energy industry. And one, your points were really well made. The energy industry has traditionally been very slow, but for very good reason. When you make massive investments that have to last for a very long time, and when your commodity is fundamentally dangerous. You don't want to be mucking around. You don't want to be changing your mind every 5 minutes. But what we've found now with technology change, particularly in the market side of things, that those changes are being forced on electricity utilities, and they're having to look at their rates of change and technology adoption under very different views. And so much as we're looking at it from a technology perspective, the biggest change, I think, from the energy perspective is not about the technology, but it's a way consumers are using the technology and how they're buying and selling energy. So what we're really seeing is a fundamental change to the business model that surrounds the supply and use of electricity.
That's a great point. Consumer expectations are a much more powerful driver for change than simply having a cool piece of technology. Now, we've also seen a huge change in the blockchain industry. The hype has thankfully died down. The conversations around blockchain and what it enables are maturing. And when we spoke earlier, you had a great anecdote on this. What happened in Dubai recently?
That's right. The World Blockchain Business Summit in Dubai about 5 or 6 weeks ago, when I flew in on the morning of the conference and I went straight to the hotel, had a quick shower and straight down to the conference venue wearing a Power Ledger t-shirt like we do for most of these kind of blockchain-based events. And I got there and everybody was wearing a suit. And it occurred to me that in just the blink of an eye, we've gone from this hype phase where you know every new serial entrepreneur was turning up to these conferences and talking about what the world of blockchain would look like and what the world of crypto could do, to a different world where you know, blockchain technology is now becoming an application in mature industries. And we're having conversations around things like governance and regulation and integration with other industry platforms. And so the people in those conferences now are not just your typical new business entrepreneurs. They're policymakers and they're regulators. And it's a very much more serious conversation now. So I turned around, went back to the hotel and threw on a tie.
Brilliant. The first time I went to a blockchain event when I was back with Intel, I rocked up in my smart business suit and tie. I walked in and I was like, uh-oh, who let granddad in? So Dave, Power Ledger provides an energy trading platform, a peer-to-peer energy trading platform. Why did you go down this path?
One of the main drivers for starting Power Ledger 3 years ago was I guess we're very lucky where we are in Western Australia. We've got a really high penetration of distributed renewables, mostly rooftop solar panels, and we have relatively expensive network-provided electricity supply. So we're getting, a bird's eye view or a heads-up view of what's coming for the rest of the world in terms of the impact of distributed, low-cost, low-carbon, renewable-generating assets. And what we're seeing is consumers are more and more inclined to generate and store their own energy, rely on traditional grids far less. And so where we are in Western Australia, more than one in four households has rooftop solar panels. In other parts of Australia, it's one in three. And we're starting to see a real impact on the underlying economics of electricity supply. So consumers are using the grid much less, but the fixed costs of running the grid are still there. So consumers who can't afford to put solar panels on their roof, either they're socially or financially marginalised or their roof points in the wrong direction, whatever the reason, those people are being locked out of the new energy economy and they're bearing the cost of everybody else getting off the grid. So we started Power Ledger with a view to say there is an opportunity for us to keep people connected. If we can keep people connected to the grid by giving them an opportunity to sell their excess solar energy to their neighbours, to monetise their investment in distributed renewables rather than just sticking it in a battery and going off grid, we can create an environment that delivers the best of both worlds. We give consumers an incentive to continue and install PV panels, but we also give people the opportunity to access that low cost and low carbon energy if they can't afford to put their own on. And we maintain the underlying kind of economic principles of a large scale efficient energy system. So that was what peer-to-peer trading was all about, giving consumers a reason to stay connected to the grid and to help keep those who couldn't afford to participate in that environment themselves a reason to or an opportunity to access low-cost and low-carbon energy.
And based on your initial peer-to-peer energy trading platform, you now have expanded to support a few other key energy markets around carbon and financing of assets.
But when you're looking at how you can trade energy from one point to another, it's all about proving the providence of every kilowatt hour that enters into the system. And if you can do that, then you can then naturally lead you on to understanding the carbon impact of that generation. So using the same underlying principle technology, we can measure, report, and validate the creation of various carbon instruments or environmental attributes in various markets. And then using the capability inherent in blockchain, the ability to fractionalize an asset and to allocate ownership to multiple parties under predetermined terms and conditions, well, then we've got the core requirements for a really efficient and accessible finance product that sits there as well. So on that base technology of peer-to-peer trading, where we're identifying the providence of every kilowatt hour, we can extend that quite naturally through to an energy financing platform.
The providence of every kilowatt, that's a good phrase. So on blockchain, how does blockchain technology support what you're up to?
I would say my role at Power Ledger is not to be a blockchain evangelist. I come from an energy perspective. So looking at the challenges inherent in managing a modern, efficient energy system when the rules of that game have changed fundamentally as well. So, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we had consistently around the world large centralized systems where we had large plant that we relied on to push energy through transmission and distribution networks to consumers at the other end who just paid for what they got. And that was the model of energy supply the world over. But what we've seen now with the uptake of low-cost, distributed renewable generating assets, the old centralized model has all of a sudden vanished on us. And we have a system of energy supply that is multi-directional and multi-user. The investments are no longer just centrally planned and authorized and maintained. We've got consumers making investment decisions that impact the system on the basis of their own personal beliefs or their own financial outcomes. So we've got a fundamentally different, physically different energy system. And if we want to get a fundamentally different outcome from our energy system, which has traditionally been high cost and high carbon energy, then we need to take a fundamentally different approach to how we arrange the markets that support it. And blockchain, because of its ability to give an immutable record and to manage the complexity of multi-party, multi-temporal transactions, becomes a really useful tool in reshaping the way we generate, we buy, and we sell electricity.
For folks who have been listening to the series so far, I would claim that we've been quite realistic on the role of blockchain in the industry. Now, some might say we've been a bit too harsh. You've been through all the hype, you've seen the tech maturing and been out there with real solutions. How do you see blockchain in the industry today?
Well, I think what you're also seeing is that because the hype's washed away, that the capabilities of the technology are better understood without all of the hype surrounding it. So we understand what it can do. We understand what it can't do as well, and where it doesn't make sense to use it. But what we're seeing now is it's been in the general thought space for long enough now that people from traditional industries who are looking at solving problems are starting to see the link between the problems that they're stuck with and they haven't been able to resolve for time immemorial are now able to be influenced or resolved by this new technology. And so it's the emergence of real need, real application, and a real opportunity to fundamentally change things. And it's coming from within mature industries. Mature industries like the energy sector are saying, well, you know, this thing we've got now just doesn't work anymore. Our market and governance structures are designed to deal with centralized large-scale generating plant and the way consumers interact with that. But that's not what our energy system looks like anymore. Physically, it's changed fundamentally. So we need a very, very different way of approaching all of that. And a technology like blockchain, now that it's emerged out of the hype cycle, is starting to present itself as a real solution to some of the challenges we face.
And onto regulation. Many would see this as the biggest obstacle to blockchain adoption. It's been clear in the series so far that everyone sees energy policy and the resulting regulations as key for us all driving the energy transition. And to be honest, blockchain or any other tech is not the main driver here. Like we had in episode 3, the regulation is key. Now, many see regulation moving too slowly. Some point the finger to regulators and say it's all their fault. But in my opinion, that's a bit unfair to the regulators. How do you see regulation playing out in the future?
I think it's playing out already. And I think regulators will be the first ones to tell you that they're regulators. They're not innovators. They don't create business models. They regulate them. And so the fact that we now have an energy system that's starting to come apart at the edges, you're seeing a traditional company, retail energy providers, traditional generators looking at different business models. And it's remarkable how different business models can actually fit within the existing regulatory framework. They're not perfect, but they can fit within the existing regulatory framework. And once we start doing that, once we start adopting new ways of buying and selling energy, like companies like BCPG are doing in Thailand, like the PEA and the MEA are doing in Thailand, like KEPCO is looking at in Japan, like Western Power is looking at here in Perth, APN in the US, when you've got these utilities looking at how can they use their existing frameworks in a different way using new technologies? Well, then we'll start to see regulators changing the rules, policymakers adopting policy positions that make it easier. So, you know, the fact is we have a burning platform. I was in a meeting on Friday with some Energy Networks Association people here and market operators here looking at how we develop a framework for the development of distributed energy markets, which is what we're talking about, distributed energy markets allowing consumers connected at a distribution level to provide services to the network as well as to obtain services from the broader system. and they've got a pipeline. I saw a time frame of about 4 years. And we sat there scratching our head thinking, this is going to come apart before then. So, you know, we could leave it to regulators. We could unfairly blame regulators for not being fast enough or nimble enough or flexible enough. The reality is there's enough flexibility in the existing frameworks to be able to demonstrate the possibilities of new technologies and demonstrate new business models. And regulators will catch up in time. But, you know, you've got to come back to the point that regulators don't create new business models. They regulate. And so it's up to industry. It's up to innovators like Power Ledger and others to propose new ways of doing business and to work with the regulators along the way, but to demonstrate how these things can fit within an existing regulatory framework, but how they can fit better if we tweak things over time.
And I'd add, most of the successful solutions I've seen out there had been tried out in conjunction with the local regulator. The concept of a regulatory sandbox has come up time and time again. The creation of such sandboxes is now being promoted here in the EU by the likes of INSOE and EDSO and others. But getting regulators to change established rules and regulations is hard. Technology is not the driver here. You know, technology is the easy bit.
That, you're absolutely right. The technology is the, and particularly in an industry like energy, is that the energy industry has historically been very, very good at adopting and integrating new technologies. The technology is the easy bit. We're used to that. You know, it's what we've done for the last 100 years. But the thing we did find difficult is the adoption of new business models and new rule sets. And you know, by far, the biggest kind of hurdles that I find, or we found in the energy space, is not the CEOs who want to find a new way of approaching customers because they understand that their business model needs to change. And it's not the guys on the ground who are having to integrate the technology. It's the people in the regulatory space who've made careers out of understanding the very complex rules and regulations around operating in the energy system. And what I'm saying to them is that the credence, you know, that your credibility or the currency of you as a professional is out the window, because we need to change those rules and we need to change them quickly. And that's where the biggest level of resistance comes from. The energy industry operates on rules. Regulatory frameworks are really well defined. They're given to utilities to say you operate within the boundaries of this regulatory paradigm. And utilities are really good at kind of, I don't want to say gaming the rules, but, you know, using the rules to their advantage. What we're saying now is the rules can go out the window because, you know, everything else has changed. And that's really where the biggest struggle or the biggest level of pushback comes from. It's not the regulators not wanting to change the rules. It's a lot of people saying, hang on, we're really comfortable with these rules because they know how they work. That's probably the biggest challenge. And the technology, as you say, that's the easy bit.
Now, Dave, if I'm a typical energy consumer out there listening to us, they might see all this as it's way too hard and there's nothing they can do. So why should they care?
Yeah. The frightening thing is that for consumers, just an individual consumer, they're probably their best interests now in many parts of the world, and Australia is probably, you know, in Australia first, is to minimise the cost of their energy by generating as much of it as they can, their own energy, storing it on site and buying as little as possible from the grid. And if that model persists, the way we pay for the grid either has to change, we need to change tariff arrangements, or we shift the cost of managing the grid to an ever-decreasing pool of consumers. So we get what we call energy poverty. So the people who can least afford it are the ones paying the most for it. Yeah, the wires, the uptake, the maintenance, the fault response, all of those sorts of things. What we need to create is an environment where consumers are encouraged to stay connected to the grid and to use that those grid assets for trading purposes in order to monetize their investment. So oversize your rooftop PV if you can, knowing that you can sell your excess energy where you have the potentials. So in Thailand, a project in Thailand, T77, is a perfect example of that. We have 9 buildings and about 700 kilowatts of solar installed across 6 of them. And the buildings range from school buildings, so an international school has a number of buildings, it's an apartment complex, tall, skinny thing, a shopping centre, a small dental hospital. And so previously, the people in the school were incentivized to put PV on their roof, but only put enough PV to cover their minimum demand. Because if they installed any more than that, it would be built into the grid and they'd get no value from it. And worse, 12 weeks of the year, there's no kids at school, they're on holiday. So all that energy is going to the grid for no value. But if we can put them into a trading environment and say, don't worry about the times of the year when you can't use your maximum demand. I'm going to sell it to the apartment building next door that's got no hope of installing PV, or to the shopping centre that's just got an almost inexhaustible demand for energy. Then we can change the fundamental economics of installing PV in the middle of Bangkok, one of the most energy-intensive cities in the world. And so that's what we're doing there. We've been working with BCPG to install PV across some of those rooftops, allowing the owners of the rooftops to sell their excess energy and to monetize their investments in ways that they haven't been able to before. So we're encouraging the uptake of PV, we're decarbonizing the energy supply, and we're giving those consumers access to energy that's cheaper than energy they could buy from the grid.
When it comes to peer-to-peer energy markets, you need to have a token. In the last episode, Maria McKavanagh from Verve talked about how their tokens work. At Power Ledger, you have the Power Token and Sparks Token. So how does all this tokenization of energy work?
So the Power Token is a utility token that gives the users of the Power Ledger platform access to the platform. So when somebody wants to, in a traditional kind of software platform sense, if you wanted to buy somebody's or utilize somebody's software platform, you pay them a license fee and probably some ongoing cost to access the platform. So the Power Token is a proxy for that. If you're a utility and you want to use the Power Ledger platform, or you're a strata company or a condominium company and you want to use the Power Ledger platform to create a trading environment within your apartment building, you access the Power Ledger software, the platform, by surrendering power tokens to Power Ledger. They're held in escrow and they act as the proxy for your software license. It gives you access to the software, gives you access to a pool of Sparks tokens, which I'll get to, and it provides something of a limited financial guarantee for the people who are trading energy in that environment, that if the application host, the condominium group, disappears with your money and you've prepaid your electricity, well, we've got hold of those power tokens. So there's some prudential coverage of the cost of that energy. So that's the Power Token. It is a utility token that gives you access to the software trading platform. Now, when we're trading electricity, we've got a really good measurement or model for trading energy, because we're reading smart meters. We can see every kilowatt hour that enters and exits the system. So if we can measure every kilowatt hour that enters into the system, we need a proxy for the value of that electricity. So we created a secondary token, a cryptographic token that has no value outside of the trading environment, but represents the value of energy. So a Sparks token is tethered to the lowest denomination of the local currency where a trading environment is. So in Australia, one Spark is worth 1 cent. And if a kilowatt hour in our trading environment is worth 15 Australian cents, then as a kilowatt hour goes from your meter to my meter, 15 Sparks goes from my digital wallet to your digital wallet. So we get a real-time transaction of the value of energy. And Sparks really just represent the value of energy, but allow us to create a financial transaction that is frictionless.
When it comes to tokens and ICOs, it has to be said that there were some ICOs in the past few years that did not do a lot to inspire confidence in the whole ICO model. Yet you've been one of the few to hold your value. What's the secret?
Yeah, and I think, there's a measure of luck, good timing and good management in that space. So as you said, we did our ICO in August through to September. The initial value of those tokens was 8.8 cents and they're currently trading at about 17 cents. So yep, they've maintained their value, they've traded higher. But during the bear market with most other cryptocurrencies, it is it contracted, but it still has held value, and it's been great for the supporters of the business and supporters of the technology or the business model that we're proposing, that the tokens have held their value. But the way the system's meant to work is that as application hosts, people adopt the use of the platform and their power tokens are then held in escrow, we reduce the circulating volume of those tokens, and which should over time increase their value. So that's really the token economy that we're trying to develop there. And really it means that for Power Ledger, we don't have to add a lot of cost into the transaction. So if our business value creation is based on the appreciation of the power token, then we don't have to have significant volumes or significant revenues from fees for energy trading. So we can keep our fees very, very low and we can still run a very successful business.
Now, I find the whole topic of token economics fascinating. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure I understand it all. when I'd review an ICO proposal for, say, an EU-wide peer-to-peer energy market that completely ignored how the actual grid worked, I was baffled.
Yeah, it's a fascinating environment. And I think there's some very solid clues from the way the energy system operates as a physical system that should give you some indications on how the token economics should also work. If somebody is telling you that they will give you a token for electricity that you produce in the south of France that they're somehow going to sell in North Africa, I mean, you should be looking at them pretty skeptically, because there needs to be some kind of physical connection to the electricity you're producing and where it's intending to be consumed. And so, you know, there's some really solid clues around how to deal with things like scale from the existing energy system. And we're not talking necessarily about creating trading markets that allow us to trade energy with any consumer in Europe, despite the amount of interconnection across Europe. What we're talking about is localized energy supplies being consumed locally in smaller scale trading environments that interact or can integrate with each other.
When I tell a startup that I did not see how their proposed energy market would actually work, I'd simply say to them that you're ignoring the laws of physics.
That's right. And that's actually been, you know, our cat's cry since the beginning, really, is we're not trying to change the laws of physics. We're trying to change the laws of the market to reflect the laws of physics. So if I'm buying energy in the middle of the day and I don't have any solar panels on my roof, but my next door neighbor, Rob, who is actually Rob, has 5 kilowatts of solar on his roof. And his kids are grown up. They've left home. He works all day. So he's got 5 kilowatts of solar panels on his roof producing energy at the same time that my kids are at home consuming energy. And our houses connect to the local distribution network at the same green dome in our front yard. So we share about 2 inches of aluminium that connects both of our house supplies to our local distribution network. So if his energy is spilling off of his roof and my kids are at home with the TV running and all the lights on and the air conditioner turned up to, you know, 1,000, the energy he's producing is being consumed in my house. The laws of physics say that. But the way the laws of the market work now is that, no, my electricity came from some coal-fired power station 300 kilometres south of Perth. So you're absolutely right. We're not trying to change the laws of physics. What we're trying to do is change the laws of the market to reflect what's actually happening and to create some means of allocating value to the people who are now contributing value to the system. So historically, it was governments, and now it's big multinationals that spend millions, billions of dollars on large-scale energy generation infrastructure. And they would make, you know, singular, one-off, multi-scale investments. Now we've got thousands of consumers making small-scale investments, but we don't give them the same ability to monetize the investment they're making. We don't acknowledge the value that their investment is contributing to the system in terms of reduced congestion or, you know, reduced peak demand, reduced network utilization, or improved network utilization. There is a whole lot of value that distributed renewables bring to the system that we're just not rewarding. And because we're not rewarding it, we're saying to the consumer, the best thing you can do is install a battery, get off the grid, and we'll see you later. And that's a disastrous impact for distribution or electricity systems the world over. We just happen to be seeing it before most people in Western Australia.
Now, the pace of change does not seem to be slowing down anytime soon. So where do you see all this headed? What's next?
What's next is, I think, the integration of artificial intelligence with trading platforms, with consumer environments. So what we're talking about now, what we're exploring at Power Ledger is not the cost of energy or the physical nature of energy supplies. What we're looking at is the consumer experience. How do we give the consumer the ability to optimize for comfort and cost and carbon in a way that they don't have to think about? How do we get them the ability to leave home in the morning and say, Alexa or Siri or whoever their home her management system is, let's make some money from the sun today. And for all the appliances in their home, all their infrastructure around their home to drop into some kind of low power demand sleep mode where the energy that they're producing on the roof is all going to being sold to their neighbours who have different power demands at that time of the day. Well, how do we give them the ability to leave home and say, when I get home, I want my house to be cool, but I don't want to do it at the expense of the environment. So I only want to use carbon-free energy to run my air conditioner. How do we give the consumers the ability to describe their their preferred lifestyle choices in a way that translates to energy consumption that is low cost and zero carbon. And I think artificial intelligence has a huge role to play in taking what at the moment is either energy trading or appliance operation and bringing those things together in a way that is seamless, that learns from the preferences of the consumer, and ultimately gives the consumer an experience in their home that they don't need to think about in terms of energy or cost or carbon. It's just optimized for all of those things.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave, for this chat on PowerLedger's third birthday. And I look forward to meeting you up in Berlin in a couple of weeks.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to catching up with you in Berlin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Energy Singularity. Please do give us a review, subscribe to receive future episodes, and please do join the conversation and share your own thoughts with us via social media. You can find details on all our social media accounts in the show notes. And be sure to visit the event site, eventhorizonsummit.com, to find out all the latest and greatest about the upcoming event. And I hope to see you all at the Event Horizon Summit this June in Berlin.